The FBI on Monday raided the offices of President Trump's longtime personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, seizing records related to several topics, including payments to pornographic film actress. Federal prosecutors in Manhattan obtained a search warrant after receiving a referral from the special counsel, Robert S. Mueller, according to Mr. Cohen's lawyer, who called the search, quote, completely inappropriate and unnecessary.
A raid on a lawyer's office is an extraordinary event. For a prosecutor, as I was, to even contemplate it is just a remarkable act of audacity, particularly when the lawyer is the sitting president's lawyer. And he has the vault. He has the keys to the kingdom. He knows all the secrets about Donald Trump. And if he were to cooperate, it would be indeed a transformative event. So the raid is seismic. And remember that when this kind of act is undertaken, there has to be more than just probable cause. The FBI and the U.S. attorney have to convince the Department of Justice that they are going to come away with very significant evidence of a crime. They have to be convinced a crime has been committed.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. With me today in the studio is...
Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where I cast psychopaths, serial killers, victims, and everything in between. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
There you go. And Laura is on the other side of the pond doing some amazing things with laws in the UK. And I think she might be in Ireland.
She might be in Ireland just kicking some, you know what? Just trying to get the laws changed. So go, girl. Do it.
Yeah. But with us today in the studio is a very special guest.
This is Sarah Azari. I'm a criminal and white collar defense attorney.
Well, it's great to have you, Sarah. And of course, Sarah and I have known each other for years now. We've kind of met on different shows that we've worked on together. And
what shows have you worked on? I don't know.
Well, we did
two segments on CNN, Dr. Drew on HLN,
and a bunch of Bellum shows.
Yes, yes, right? Yes. Corrupt Crimes.
There you go. Corrupt Crimes back in the day. So Sarah's here today because we wanted to discuss what's been going on, a very significant development in the law, in illegal circles, that has to do with crime and criminal investigations. And that is, there was a raid on Michael Cohen's office, and he happens to be his attorney for Donald Trump, among other people. And the fact that a lawyer's office could be raided by the FBI, that's a major, significant development, isn't it?
It's totally extraordinary because normally, due to the sensitive nature of items and communications that are found in a lawyer's office, namely that they're privileged communications with the lawyer's client, the way to go about this is for the government, for the FBI, to subpoena those records. And so when they go in and essentially knock and raid, which they did in Michael Cohen's case, it signifies that they're concerned that evidence would be destroyed or concealed.
Right. So DOJ is the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, and that basically is the seat of the criminal prosecution and civil prosecution for the U.S. government. It's the federal prosecution agency in the United States. The FBI is a component of the Department of Justice, as well as the U.S. Attorney's Office. Can we go back a little bit and can you explain to our listeners what the attorney-client privilege is?
It is when there's communications between an attorney and a client, and there's advice given by the attorney to the client, those communications are confidential and therefore privileged, meaning they can't be discovered by third parties. Now, that privilege can be waived if the holder of the privilege is the client. It can be waived by the client, and there's also exceptions to that privilege. So, so the one exception that has been sort of, we've been seeing this in the news, applicable to Michael Cohen's situation is the crime fraud exception, which is if the attorney and the client are communicating with respect to the commission of or furtherance of a crime, the client then can't say, oh, wait a minute, this document or this communication is privileged. The privilege is gone.
Mm. So you'd have to, as a federal investigator and a prosecutor, would have to present to a judge to get a search warrant. They would have to get information that there was a crime being committed, and that information would have to pass the probable cause muster test, right?
Absolutely.
How hard is it to
Well, I think, look, I think we don't have the search warrant and the affidavit to the search warrant, which is even more important in this case because it's still sealed. But once it's unsealed, we'll be able to see in detail. But from the arguments that have been made in court with respect to who determines what is and is not privileged that's been seized, we can already tell that there's substantial information that the DOJ presented to have this search warrant issued in the first place of crimes such as money laundering, bank fraud, wire fraud, with Michael Cohen's business dealings, and of course, campaign finance violations. So we know enough to know that there's substantial statement of probable cause that the evidence of crimes existed in his home.
But we should point out right from the start that there was a statement by Rod Rosenstein, who is the deputy attorney general, who is sort of stepped into the place of the attorney general in this particular case because the attorney general was conflicted out, that he said Donald Trump is not target this investigation.
And he's not. I think here's what's important about this is that Donald Trump is not the target. Michael Cohen is the target. But Donald Trump apparently is one of three or maybe five at most clients that Michael Cohen had. It's not like he's running a big law firm. And that status of being a subject who's named specifically in the search warrant can very quickly change to being a target. So in the course of this investigation, as it unfolds and as the FBI and the Southern District of New York find incriminating information that may have to do with Donald Trump, guess what? Suddenly Donald Trump is a target.
Sure. So it's a fluid turn of phrase.
Absolutely.
So I have to admit something. I hate to admit it. I have to confess that in the past 2 months, two or three months, I've been an ostrich. Like, I don't want to hear the news. I don't want to watch. Like, there's so many people screaming, the sky is falling. This one, that one, this one's suing. There's a porn star here. There's a this, that. I don't know what to follow and who to believe and what's important, what's not important. So I'm not nearly as up to speed as you, and I know many of our listeners. So does this, the DOJ raid, FBI raid, have anything to do with the Mueller investigation?
You're not alone, first of all. I think a lot of people have shut out because it's just, it's very easy to lose sight of why this is even relevant, especially to, you know, President Trump's base, who doesn't seem to care about what, you know, what comes out in terms of negative information about him. But the significance of this is, and I've been saying this, is that the Cohen investigation is far more imminently perilous to Donald Trump than the Mueller investigation. So Robert Mueller has made it clear that his investigation is limited to collusion with Russia over the 2016 elections. And he's not going to bother with any other ancillary type of
which is why this particular case was referred to the Southern District of New York. So the New York U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York became the actual jurisdiction that is going to be working this case.
Because Cohen lives there or what?
His offices were there.
Yes, his offices were there. He lives there. You know, the crimes that are being investigated allegedly occurred there. So they have jurisdiction. But you know what? This can very easily revert back to Mueller, at least as to part of it, because again, as the investigation moves forward, there may be evidence uncovered that relates to the Russia collusion issue. And then guess what? That part of this investigation will go back to Mueller.
So are you saying that the Mueller team discovered these things that triggered, and so then they pushed it to this other party?
Yeah, let me just give you an example of that. I was on the Whitewater investigation back in 94, 95, 96. And during the course of that investigation, we had a total of 13 different prosecutions. Mm-hmm. We went to the Supreme Court a bunch of times on legal issues and so forth. But towards the end of my period there, which was over a year and a half that I was on the investigation, I did the Webb Hubble investigations and prosecutions and convictions. And then I did the Vince Foster equivocal death investigation. But towards the end of that time, somebody named Linda Tripp came into our office and said she had information. Monica Lewinsky told Linda Tripp that if she would sign this affidavit that said that she was unaware of Bill Clinton sexually harassing any females, that Monica would give Linda Tripp the deed to her Watergate apartment. Watergate is a very expensive and notorious property in Washington, D.C., right on the river. And Linda thought she was being sort of extorted to lie. So she came into the prosecutor's office and the special counsel's office, Starr's office at that time. And immediately we wrote that up. I wasn't the one that actually wrote it up, but one of the lawyers wrote it up and we sent it to the Department of Justice and said, here you go. This is not within our jurisdiction, but you should probably take a look at this. And Janet Reno sent it right back and said, no, you're going to do this. So that's when Ken Starr had to start that investigation into Monica Lewinsky. Right. Now, of course, that was just at the time when I got kind of promoted out and ended up in the behavioral analysis unit. Mm-hmm. So I did not take part in that investigation. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting turn. But it just like in this case, there was a referral out. But in that case, it came right back.
Right.
In this case, it could come right back, as you said.
I think one of the things that I anticipate will happen is that Michael Cohen will flip. And in the course of his cooperation with the government and proffer sessions where he's providing information about what he knows, he's not just limited to, you know, the main focus of this investigation. He can talk about information he has on any and all crimes by any and all people. And again, he's the consigliere to Donald Trump for decades. So I expect that he may provide, number one, I believe he will flip. People will generally
talk about that. Let's talk about what that means. In the legal parlance, basically that means that if the Southern District of New York indicts Michael Cohen on any number of federal crimes, and they could also refer for local crimes, right. to the local district attorney's office, that they could then say, we'll take a proffer from you. In other words, we'll give you immunity for what you tell us. They call it a queen for a day in the Southern District.
Yeah,
and they could say anything, but if they lie about anything or they don't tell the whole truth about anything, then that is all invalidated. So that will give them an opportunity to get a cooperation letter, which is very important because a cooperation letter allows the prosecutor to ask the judge to step outside the sentencing guidelines and give the defendant a lower sentence.
Yeah, sometimes it could mean you get probation and you get no time. It just depends on the quality of what you do. I always tell clients, this is an opportunity for you to minimize your exposure, your time. But we can't go in there half pregnant. You know, you're either pregnant or you're not. You either provide the whole truth and nothing but the truth, or let's just not even do this because it can't actually backfire. But this is something, you know, Michael Cohen has always said he'll take a bullet for the president. He'll be just loyal till the end. People change very quickly when they're facing hard times. This is a man who's middle-aged with a family. And I think Jim and I both dealt with people like that in the criminal justice system. And, you know, at that point, your loyalty is just owed to yourself and your family. I mean, you're trying to get out of the situation as best you can. And by the way, this whole concept of flipping and cooperation is not just for these types of white collar situations in federal district courts. It also applies to, you know, people that are indicted in, you know, street crimes.
And has he ever been tested before in this way? I mean, has he ever been?
No, this is almost unprecedented.
Yeah.
I mean, I know in the course of my career in the FBI and as a prosecutor, I mean, maybe this has happened once or twice before in the last 30 years that I'm aware of, where an attorney's offices, not in his office, his home, his hotel room, they were all raided, searched, and And I know at least some electronic devices have been seized. I don't know what else has been seized. Mm-hmm. But
can you name any other cases, Jim, just for reference?
I can't off the top of my head. That's how rare they are. Yeah. Can you, Sarah?
No, they're often subpoenaed. That's why this is such a strong indication that there is this great concern by the Southern District of New York that evidence would be destroyed. And interestingly, they have not identified any emails between Michael Cohen and Donald Trump, which is a little strange.
Except he doesn't use email.
Donald Trump doesn't
no,
use email?
No, Donald Trump does not use email.
Okay. All right. He tweets a lot. I just figured
he does, but he does not use email.
Who hasn't found any emails?
Yeah. They haven't referenced it.
Yeah, they haven't referenced it. They don't, in a skim of what was seized, it doesn't appear like emails with him directly. That doesn't mean they can't email his aid or
yeah, well, that's what I've heard, that Trump does not rely on
interesting. Either. Okay, all right. Well, that might be good for him in this case.
Yeah. It's probably a smart move. Maybe he learned something from Hillary's actions.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Well, what do you mean, here we go? I mean, let's go.
No, I don't want to go anywhere, please. You know, our listeners know that this is not real political profile. I mean, we want to keep things apolitical. Yeah. I mean, we have listeners from every corner of the country and
around the world.
When the FBI uses a raid like this, that tells us that they believed and considered a subpoena, but thought, we don't trust this individual with a subpoena to look for the documents himself. We need to do it ourselves and go in there without notice so that documents don't have a way of poof, vanishing.
So, Sarah, could you opine on what you think they might be after in Cohen's material?
So far, one thing to keep in mind is that we don't have the search warrant affidavit, which would give us a better idea of what this investigation specifically is about. But we know that it involves financial transactions having to do with his taxi business, Cohen's taxi business in New York.
Cohen owns the taxi cab company?
A taxi fleet in New York.
Really?
Yeah.
Like town cars, not like.
I'm not sure exactly like what kind of transportation, but that's sort of one of his things. Then there's these multiple hush monies that were paid out as part of an NDA, such as Stormy Daniels, McDougal, the catch and kills, so to speak, also. Catch and kill is when a publisher of a magazine gets the exclusive rights to your story, pays you for it, but then kills the story. So it's a way to keep you silent. It's an alternative, let's say, to an NDA, so to speak. So Michael Cohen was behind catch and kill by AMI, which is the publisher for National Enquirer, whose head is buddies with Michael Cohen. So there's been this pattern of potentially monies that Michael Cohen negotiated to be paid out to women very shortly before the 2016 elections, which raises the issue of whether these are campaign finance violations. And so my point is, in response to your question, that there's definitely a money trail that's being investigated by the Southern District of New York. They're looking at financial transactions, bank records, communications that show that perhaps there was money laundering, there was, campaign finance violations, bank fraud.
And the reason why the Southern District would be looking at those things, because one of the major ways into any criminal investigation by the federal government is wire fraud.
Yep.
As well, wire fraud, in other words, using interstate modalities to further your crime, but also bank fraud, because the FDIC insures deposits in bank. And so if a bank loses money, federal government loses money, so it makes it a federal crime. So there has to be a federal nexus or a connection between the federal government and a crime for the FBI or the Department of Justice to investigate it.
But a catch and kill isn't illegal. I mean,
the catch and kill is not illegal. The issue is that it was done so close to the elections. And so then it becomes the issue of what becomes illegal is if these were campaign finance violations, in other words, subject to disclosures that were never made.
In other words, it's the money that was used to pay off Stormy Daniels. And we should probably back up and talk about what that whole situation is, just for our international listeners. Mm-hmm. But if the money that was used to pay her off was actually raised in campaign finances or some other way like that, then it should have been disclosed. It can't be, you can't just use money like that and not tell the.
Well, and there's also, well, but there's also a threshold amount where I think it's $1,500 or $1,000. If you are, remember, Michael Cohen saying, I took this out of my home line of equity. Donald Trump had no knowledge that I was doing this. And so it was done 3 weeks before the election. So if he did this to benefit Trump in the elections, you know, to kind of make the story go away because it's negative information about him, and the money, $130,000, is over the threshold amount, then there's disclosures that have to be made. And those
right. So if it is, in effect, a campaign donation by Cohen
right, exactly.
to Trump mm-hmm. because it helped his campaign mm-hmm. by not having her come out right at that particular time.
Exactly.
Then that could be seen as a donation that was not disclosed
exactly.
and way over the limit of what somebody can donate
right.
to. The
exactly. Without disclosing. Yeah.
But if President Trump had just paid, what if he had paid Stormy himself and used his own money, not from campaign?
If he had, that would be a different thing.
Yeah. That'd probably be better for him in a way.
Yeah. In a way,
he's denying
any knowledge that it happened. So he couldn't have paid. Right. So the way it got done, I mean, it's just,
the lies are worse than the truth.
Exactly. And that's the point. And I think that's the lesson for anyone with some, you know, exposure to, I guess, unsavory information that might be out there about them, is that if you could just own up to the truth and, you know, get good counsel so that they can handle the disclosure of that truth in the best way possible for you, that's the best way to go about it. When you start lying and covering up, then you're like, then you might be making it worse and then, you know, committing other crimes.
Yeah, we can go back to the time of Ronald Reagan. There was this phrase that became very popular towards the end of his presidency, plausible deniability. Mm-hmm. And that's what Donald Trump has now with respect to the Stormy Daniels case. He's mm-hmm. plausibly denying that he had any knowledge of this payment to shut her up. And right now, that's where it sits. However, Michael Cohen flips, or if there's some information that there was some transaction and some conversation back and forth between him and Trump during the time period before this payment, and then this payment was made, that plausible deniability may be going away.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Stormy Daniels case and the $130,000 hush money that was paid to her. I mean, as we're recording this podcast, Stormy Daniels and her attorney, Michael Avenatti, are in federal court in Los Angeles fighting Michael Cohen's attorneys who are trying to get a what's called a stay of the case. Yeah, that case is civil. It's not criminal. Michael Cohen is obviously involved in a federal criminal investigation. He is a target in that investigation and with high exposure. So in these situations, the court, when there is a civil case also going on, the court often favors the person who has the exposure and allows them to essentially put the case on hold. And that's what the stay means. So Michael Avenatti is saying, no, in this quest for the truth, we don't want to wait. We want the American public to know right away. I happen to know this judge. I appear before this judge regularly. It has been very evident to me from his rulings in this case that he'd rather put this case on hold. And so I think this gives him an opportunity, a very valid opportunity, you know, supported by law, to actually grant a stay. Because otherwise, Cohen will have to invoke his Fifth Amendment to remain silent. Because how could he possibly defend himself in the civil case when everything he could say could be used against him in the criminal case by the Southern District?
What do they want in the civil case? What is Stormy, Ms. Daniels, and Avenatti?
Right. Well, what we have heard in the media is that they want the American public to know the truth, that she is done with bullying. She was bullied into signing an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, to keep the story silent. And the payment was very low, so clearly she didn't negotiate it. She was pushed into this agreement.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the other guy that Michael Cohen's client got paid $1.2 million, right, for his story.
You mean the GOP donor?
I thought it was, no, the guy who...
He has a client who's like he's the RNC finance chair or something like that, who impregnated a playmate or someone in Los Angeles. I think the RNC chair also lives in Los Angeles. And so, yeah, that was in the millions. But I think it's because she got pregnant.
All right. Well, either way, I get it. But the point is that, you know, it may sound like a whole lot of money to us, but in terms of how it that information might have affected the vote for the presidency, that information could have been sold for a whole hell of a lot more than that.
Yeah. So she's suing for more money.
No, she's suing. No. I'll give you back the $130,000 you gave me so that I'm free to talk about this without being penalized. Because in that non-disclosure agreement, she's subject to $1 million. And that's what makes that ridiculous as well. $1 million per incident, meaning each time she talks about the affair with Donald Trump.
She must be racking up billions by now because she's talking about it all over the place.
I don't disagree with you. I think the book deal is there. I think the appearances, paid appearances, she will be paid far more than the $130,000. But legally speaking, she's bound by that agreement and she's trying to invalidate it.
Yeah. And what she's claiming is that actually the actions, which you earlier called bullying, mm-hmm. were actually coercive and that she did not freely sign that deal and so on and so forth. So let's talk about that because that's a word that we use a lot on Real Crime Profile, mm-hmm. coercion and coercive control and so forth. Mm-hmm. So let's just talk about the underlying situation. And that is, there is an allegation by this woman who calls herself Stormy Daniels that she had a one-time affair with Donald Trump. And obviously, she claims that it was during his current marriage. And of course, that would be damaging information if it came out right on the eve of the election. And so her allegation is that she was paid hush money so that it wouldn't hurt Donald Trump's presidential bid. But she claims that on top of this, having to sign this agreement, that she would not talk about it. And if she did talk about it, it would cost her $1 million every time she talked about it. She claims that somebody came up to her and threatened her, right? And her daughter, right?
That's right. That she was at a mommy and me class and getting her daughter into her car, out of her car. And a guy came up to her, you know, a very normal looking guy. She thought he was just like another daddy there and threatened her and her daughter and, you know, really scared her.
Yeah. So here's the thing. She's recently done a session with a police sketch artist and came up with a sketch of this guy, as she recalled, from 10 years ago, was mm-hmm. it?
Right. 2011. So right. 7 years ago. A long time ago for someone to remember specifically. I mean, Jim, this is your forte. But,
right. I always harken back to the most famous sketch in the history of U.S. law enforcement, and that is the sketch of the Unabomber. And it's an infamous, iconic sketch of a guy with big aviator sunglasses and a stash and a hoodie on. And that was done by a woman who witnessed her boss kicking a piece of wood in the parking lot next to his car and getting killed. Mm-hmm. And it almost killed the woman as well. It was really a devastating blast. But she had done a sketch originally at the time, and then 7 years later, they wanted to update that sketch. And what happened was she did the sketch and it was circulated around. But when push came to shove later, it was found that the guy who actually did the sketch the first time, that's who she described. She described,
the second time she described
the guy who did the sketch the first time. So she substituted in her brain that memory. But the sketch was so effective, though, because Ted went underground at that point and didn't come out for another 6 years or 7 years. And so he thought it was close enough to him so that he was scared to come out and do more bombings.
So how different were the two sketches? Were they significantly different?
They were significantly different. Yeah, they were. And strangely enough, TMZ is reporting, and I've looked at the pictures, it's her husband. Looks a whole hell of a lot like this sketch. And I will say definitely the mouth area looks almost indistinguishable.
Yeah, I took a brief look at it. I agree with you. I think there's a striking similarity. There's only one person that she told at the time when this incident occurred. What I saw on TMZ.com also, I agree, looks very, very similar to the sketch.
Stormy Daniels nailed the description of the man, she says, threatened her way back in 2011 because he looks exactly like the guy sleeping next to her. We're not saying Stormy Daniels' husband, Brendan Miller, is the guy who warned her to back off Trump. We're saying she might have gotten a little confused while talking to the sketch artist. So look at the pictures. I mean, just a big, broad, flat forehead, the lips.
Nose, the mouth. Yeah. Looks like a soap star to me. I mean, he looks very LA, you know.
The only thing that's missing is his detailed tattoos on his shoulder. But what's crazy is that this kind of really invalidates what she's saying and could create some serious problems and for her statements. And
To be honest, I did not think that the sketch was necessary. I mean, if I represented her, I probably wouldn't go that far. I think she established her credibility on 60 Minutes in the interview. She had taken a polygraph, which Michael Avenatti, her lawyer, indicated was on a DVD. He tweeted out about it. So I don't think anyone was questioning her credibility. And to go this far to try to, you know, for right. the quest for the thug. I mean, it's just a little bit. What are the chances that they'll find this guy?
Not from that sketch, but let's talk about that. Why? Why was that something that went too far? Well, yes, it was dramatic and maybe it was overly dramatic. But here's the problem, and her lawyer should have been more sophisticated about this. Eyewitness testimony is the absolute least reliable type of evidence that could be put in a trial. And when you have somebody who only has a momentary connection to another human being, only sees them for a short period of time, it's very, very difficult to implant in your memory unless it's incredibly traumatic, which she says this event was. But after all these years, 7 years later, having not done it contemporaneously with...
It's even more unreliable, right?
Of course it's unreliable, more unreliable. But the fact is that, unfortunately, the way our memory works, it's not what we think. We don't have a digital camera in our brain.
Right.
What we have are different centers in our brain which store different types of information. Mm-hmm. So the look, the feel, the sound, the temperature, the speed at which things happen, all those things are stored in different areas of our brain. And in order to pull out that memory, you have to link up all those pieces. They're not stored in one specific place.
I mean, this is 7 years. We're talking about 7 years of memory, right, that she has to recall to say, oh, yeah, I can identify the guy if he walks through the door. I was a victim of hit and run a few years back. And I saw that the guy was African-American. That's all. I mean, that's all I could. It was dark. It was raining. And he was very well-dressed, you know, very preppy, kind of like a plaid purple shirt and a tie. And so months later, I think it was like 6 or 7 months later, when the police called me to do a photo lineup identification, you know, I think it was a good lineup, but what got me to choose the right person was the way he was dressed.
Really.
You know what I mean? And I happened
really
to
hit with him?
Absolutely. I said, this guy and that's the guy. You know, okay. This guy.
So let's talk about that. So if this guy walked up to Stormy Daniels again, her brain would be taking in a lot more information other than just the physical, just like you did. It's the style that got you, right? He wasn't wearing the same clothes. Yeah. He was wearing the same style of clothes, right?
Yeah.
So the style of the clothing, the way he carried himself, the way he walks, the his tone style, of his voice, the pitch, pace, volume of his voice, all those things, his scent, all those things would be coming at her at the same time. So she may not be able to pinpoint, oh, he was wearing this cologne, he was this tall, he was this broad, he was this heavy, he was this, how he walked this way. But her brain would take in that information. You can instantly recognize somebody sometimes, but it's because you have all these other factors, not just how they look. And sometimes, you know, you could say, did you focus on his nose or his eyes or his ears or whatever? There might be some time that they're focused on. But sometimes if somebody has a gun, all they see is a big round hole pointing at them, and that's all they focus on.
Yeah, on top of that, she's processing what he's saying to her and processing, my kid is right here. I mean,
there's a lot going on for her to take in.
So I don't question for a minute why she screwed up that
sketch.
Because it wasn't contemporaneous, and because She is just an eyewitness, a temporary eyewitness. Mm-hmm. If it was somebody she had known for a long time,
yeah.
if she had spent months with this guy,
right.
you know, that the reliability of that sketch right. and the accuracy of that, it would go up tremendously.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the same thing you could say for voice identifications, yeah. for example. Mm-hmm. If you just hear somebody once and then you say, and then a cop plays you a voice and says, is that him? Mm-hmm. Well, how reliable is that? I mean, how suggestible is that? But then if you have known somebody for months and years and live with them and all this stuff, well, you know nuances that you can't really explain, but they actually click in. Your subconscious calculates things so much faster than you think. And it would have been better if she didn't try that.
I agree with you. I think it was unnecessary, but I think it's, you know, the her position and her attorney's position have been not just that she was wronged in the amount of the hush money and you know and the bullying tactics between the attorneys, but that there's thuggish behavior. He's repeatedly said that Michael Cohen is a thug and that he expects that there's going to be more evidence of his actions with respect to others. So in a way, releasing the sketch sort of. I mean, it's sort of a message that watch out, there might be a pattern of this type of thing coming out as a result of this raid.
Well, we'll see. I mean, but I just obviously the credibility of that sketch is just almost zero at this point because it just bears such a striking resemblance to her husband.
Donald Trump, the only thing he's ever said about the Stormy Daniels accusations and the case in general is that sketch is a con job. That's what he tweeted the other day. And that's all he's ever said about this case.
On his way back from a tax cuts event in West Virginia Thursday, President Trump said he didn't know about a payment his lawyer made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Mr. Trump also said he doesn't know why his personal attorney, Michael Cohen, made the payment.
Didn't he make some kind of statement that...
On Air Force One, he said that he didn't know about the payment by Michael Cohen. And that's... That could come in and prove, I mean, you know, if they prove otherwise, if Michael Cohen flips and talks and says, no, I talked to Donald Trump and...
Can I just ask you something?
Yeah.
As an attorney, a defense attorney, is Michael Cohen a defense attorney?
Michael Cohen, I believe, is... I don't know what kind of attorney he is. I don't know if he's a family law attorney or business attorney, but... Honestly, not to talk bad about the guy, but he seems to me more of a hustler and a deal broker than a real lawyer. So I don't really know what kind of specialty he has, if any. But yes, Donald, you're right. Donald Trump made a statement on Air Force One that he had no knowledge of this hush money paid to Stormy Daniels.
And so let me just ask you, as an attorney, would you do something like that? In other words, would you take money out of your home to pay off somebody without discussing it with the target?
You know, it is an ethical violation almost in every state for a lawyer to do anything for the client, even if it's in the client's benefit, without the client's knowledge and consent. So there's no way I would do that because I could lose my license, even though I'm doing a good thing. And I'm being generous and I'm being kind. It's interesting because Michael Cohen's buddy, who came out in the media as his also temporary lawyer, who's now disappeared, of course, David Schwartz, said he did it out of love. You know, he did this on Meg Kelly and it was really funny because it was like, wow, you know, first of all, I don't love my clients that much.
Usually clients pay lawyers rather than lawyers.
It's one way.
But if it's not true, why would you have to pay at all? I mean, that's the thing I don't understand. You could, you know.
Because this guy, you know, for many years, been the fixer. That's what he calls himself. It's like anything that possibly bad that might happen to Donald Trump, he'd go out and fix. And so he's kind of saying, look, I did it as a lawyer, but as a buddy, as a protector, you know, and I didn't want this bad information to come out. So I just took the money out of my home line of equity. It's really incredulous.
I believe he did that deliberately because if he took it out of his bank account, well, Donald Trump presumably paid him fees so it can make it look like he's actually taking fees from Donald and paying it out. So instead, absolutely, he created this fantasy by saying, oh, I'm going to take a loan against my house.
Right.
I'm sure he has plenty of money in the bank.
Absolutely.
And he could use that in a heartbeat.
And that money went, I believe, to his personal account. And then that's why money laundering is an issue here, too. And it went to his personal account, and then it was transferred to this company that he created just for the Stormy payment called ECLLC. And then it was ultimately transferred out of that account. It's a lot of steps to take for $130,000 for love. Yeah. And it's an incredible story because lawyers don't do that.
Well, without the knowledge, legit lawyers don't do that. Right. So the question is, what's going to happen? Right. So let's just talk about it. And without getting political, because literally, I'm very apolitical. I don't like politics at all. And it just really has no place on this podcast. But can you tell us what this means in terms of, you know, the Stormy Daniels case, in terms of, yeah, like what's going to happen with, you know, I mean, this is everybody who's ever engaged an attorney in this country has to rely on that attorney-client privilege. And now it seems like, wow, that's just out the window.
I don't think it's out the window. I think that there's a stated reason in that search warrant affidavit why these unusual circumstances had to be essentially followed, and the fact that they raided Michael Cohen as opposed to allow him to respond by subpoena, and I think that's something that will, it's not going to set a precedent. It's going to explain why this was extraordinary, essentially. And the attorney-client privilege, like I said, is not absolute. But to determine whether there is privileged communications in what they seized from Michael Cohen's home and office, someone has to do that review and vetting, right? So traditionally, the Department of Justice creates what's called a taint team, which is a group of prosecutors disconnected, unrelated to this investigation, who will go through these documents and say, okay, these are privileged, which means we cannot review them and use them in our investigation, and the rest are not, which is fair game for us. But as a defense attorney, you know, I call it BS because it's a fake Chinese wall that the Department of Justice creates to essentially be able to say the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. I don't feel comfortable with me, but that is the norm.
And it's a terrible name, by the way.
Yes. But on the other hand, yes, we used to call it a Chinese wall, and it happens almost every day in law firms, right, not just in the government, but in law firms when they have clients that might have adverse positions related to each other.
Conflicts of interest.
And as long as it is stated, as long as it is disclosed, then it can be legitimate. And I have been on a Chinese wall team at some point in my career, and I do believe it can be done, and it is a legitimate legal methodology so that somebody can actually vet and make sure that the clients or the subjects or the targets' rights are protected. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not perfect. Is it subject to somebody violating it? Of course, but it is a mechanism in which the government can function and do this
it's
job.
It's definitely the norm, and it's definitely the preferred mechanism for the prosecution. But Michael Cohen and, surprisingly, Donald Trump's attorneys made some, what I find, absurd requests of the court in Southern District of New York. Michael Cohen came in and said, no, I should be allowed to get back these records and review them to see what's privileged. Well, if they felt like that was an option, they would just subpoena the records in the first place. So that was not a good request or, you know, reasonable request. And then Donald Trump made the same request, which to me was so appalling because Donald Trump's has no standing. He's not the lawyer. It's not his office that was raided, and he's not a target. But he said, because I'm the owner of the privilege and I'm the invoker of the privilege, I'm best suited to, and I have to say that I, and I'm.
But then he's almost saying that I'm the only client and I'm the only one that could be hurt by this.
I should do the review.
Yeah, right? But yeah. that's somewhat.
Yeah, why not distance? He should be distancing himself.
And I would hope that wasn't his attorney. I don't think it was her idea, but nonetheless, those requests were denied. And now it looks like what's going to happen is a special master will get assigned for the review and the vetting of documents for privilege. And a special master is essentially a separate agency or a body that has lawyers that come in and are completely separate from the prosecution and unrelated to the defense. And I think that's a fair, you know, judges essentially splitting the baby, and it's a fair resolution to this issue of, however, you know, it's going to delay the investigation because there's going to be bickering now about what is and isn't privileged, you know, going back and forth between this intermediary, the special master. And so the prosecutor is not very happy because they're also having to now reveal more and more about their investigation, which they didn't want to do. Over the, you know, these quarrels over the privileged material. So
this is like Game of Thrones. You got the special maester over here. You got the taint here. You got the Chinese wall. You got the Mexican wall now.
Yeah, that's kind of on hold, I think, right now. Yeah.
So can we talk about another, potential ramification here? So in this situation, because this case has been referred to the Southern District of New York, where presumably, if there were federal crimes that they were committed in New York, there's also concurrent jurisdiction in New York State, right? So if Michael Cohen committed crimes in the city of New York and in the state of New York, those prosecutors could decide to prosecute him, even though the feds are also prosecuting him.
Well, there's the issue of double jeopardy, which is that this is a basic rule of law in our nation, in our country, in our constitution, essentially that a person cannot be prosecuted twice for the same crime. Now, there's a couple things that could happen. It could be that in the course of this investigation, that the Southern District of New York prosecutors, the federal prosecutors, come across crimes that maybe aren't worthy of federal resources, and they kick those down to the DA's office or the attorney general's office for prosecution on a state level, and then they prosecute the rest on the federal level. But there's another and a bigger and a more important issue here is that if Michael Cohen is indicted in the Southern District of New York and he's convicted either by jury or enters into a plea agreement of some sort, one of the concerns is that Donald Trump could pardon him. Donald Trump has a track record for pardoning people that he likes, that are loyal to him, that are his allies, or he likes what they've said about him. You know, Sheriff Arpaio, Scooter Libby recently, and because presidents can pardon people for federal crimes, but
federal crimes.
So, but presidents cannot pardon you for a state crime. And so right now what's going on is the Attorney General of New York is trying to add an exception to the double jeopardy law in New York that allows the state of New York to prosecute someone who has been pardoned by a president, even like, in other words, re-prosecute them for the same crime that usually would be subject to double jeopardy.
But I don't know about that. My understanding of double jeopardy is when you commit a crime that is a federal crime and a state crime, those are two separate crimes. And you can actually prosecute. We've done it hundreds of thousands of times for, let's say, child sex crimes.
You can have parallel prosecutions. Yeah. But often, I don't want to say always, the state defers to the feds. They have better resources. They have, they're more capable of prosecuting.
And they have the sentencing guidelines that are usually a lot tougher.
It's tougher. There's more at stake for the defendant who's convicted in the feds.
I don't understand why the Attorney General of New York would have to actually add an exception when, in fact, there are, there's plenty of precedent that they could concurrently prosecute.
Right. But in my experience, and I don't practice in New York, I practice in California, often the even though they can parallel prosecute or simultaneously prosecute, the federal prosecutors ask that they don't because it interferes with their methodology and all that.
But could they do it afterwards?
Afterwards, I mean, I guess it's just usually not
I know it's not done normally,
it's not
but
done.
All right, let me just tell
and
you why.
But, I mean, don't you think it's a big deal that they're so the Attorney General's office in New York is so concerned that Donald Trump will continue misusing his presidential pardon power that he's trying to change the law so that if Cohen is convicted and pardoned, that he double jeopardy doesn't apply. That he, you know.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think there might be another reason why. Because there have been a number of rumblings about Trump firing Rod Rosenstein and Mueller. But because this is now a Southern District of New York case, it wouldn't affect this investigation at all.
At all.
It would continue to go forward unless Trump appointed a new attorney general to the United States of America. And that new attorney general basically said to the Southern District, shut down that investigation.
Right.
But if they did that, the state of New York and the city of New York and the county of New York could all still prosecute him.
Absolutely. And I think they would.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see. This is a very, very unique and high level type of legal circumstance we find ourselves in.
I think what's important for your listeners is that even though it seems very political because of the people involved and the, you know, the federal jurisdiction and all that, I think it's important to remember that the principles and the issues that are at play right now in this case apply to a lot of other criminal cases.
Absolutely, which is why we wanted to discuss it, because literally, although, yes, it does have a tangential link to a political issue, we're not talking about that. We're talking just the legal side of it. It's so fascinating. I mean, you know, when I went to law school, like we never, I never ever thought that this, something like this would happen because of the sanctity of that attorney-client privilege. But when you have situations, the only other time I ever heard about this is, I think the lawyer, I do remember now, Bruce Cutler was Don Gotti's attorney. And at one point he ended up getting indicted as part of the case against John Gotti. And during the course of that.
And how about in law school when we learned that that the presidential pardon is nearly impossible, even the, you know, pardon by the governor is nearly impossible. I mean, I have clients who turn their lives around after a conviction and decades pass and they're still not pardoned for some, you know, minor wrongdoing. And here we have a president who's left and right pardoning people for some big, big crime.
Typically, correct me if I'm wrong, but typically the president does this sort of as he's leaving office, like are a couple times during his career where he basically looks at potential pardon, somebody who's been, you know, the system has crushed them or something traumatic has happened or, you know, there's a lot of question as to whether they were actually guilty in the first place or they were like, you know, a target politically for some reason at some time, and the president ends up granting them a pardon.
It's not
the
a first time entry into office.
Right. Not as soon as he gets there and, you know, and anybody that, you know, people that were associated with him directly and people that, you know, sort of have had very tumultuous careers that he, you know.
And no rehabilitation. I mean, really.
No, because it's while it's going on.
Right.
It's not 20 years later.
Exactly. And even with Scooter Libby, it's like, you know, you said, well, he got his law license back. And it's like, how does that justify that he should also be pardoned? I mean, it's a different standard. You know, what a professional licensing agency thinks you should have done to get your license back versus, you know.
Criminal law.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I was just going to ask what the parameters are, what the legal parameters are.
I think what Jim said, where, you know, where there's been some kind of a failure by the criminal justice system, some kind of a travesty of justice, so to speak, and a significant period passed, you know, usually it's like decades, you know, since the crime was committed. You've paid your dues, you've given back to the community, you've shown a record of rehabilitation. You know, it's
redemption.
There's major redemption, not just because the president likes you.
Well, I gotta thank you for pulling my head out of the sand temporarily. I think I'm gonna go dive right back in because I will not keep all this straight. But I can't believe how much I've learned. My God,
yeah, it's been really interesting, and I'm really interested in seeing how this goes. And you know, literally, I want this country to do the best, and I want the best for this country, and I'm not, I believe that politically this country likes to swing back and forth between extremes, and nobody wants to go down the middle. I would love to be down the middle politically. Since that doesn't happen, I kind of stay out of politics in general. So I just hope that whatever happens here in this case, that things work out well for the entire country, and that we are all, not hurt by the extreme that this case represents.
Yeah, I agree. It does make a difference for all of us who are, in the throes of the practice of criminal defense on a daily basis as well.
I feel like we kind of need to drop this podcast immediately because things are changing so quickly, it's crazy.
Yeah, and please, would you come back?
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
You're going to be at Crime Con? You're going to be at Crime Con, right?
I will be at Crime Con. I'm so excited about that. And there's so much going on. You know, the Bill Cosby trial. There's a lot of stuff that we can talk about. So I look forward to rejoining you.
Well, what I'm saying is if there are developments in this particular case,
sure,
maybe we could come back and discuss that, because I'm really interested in seeing what's going to happen.
Yep.
Well, they're anticipating a fairly quick indictment within 90 days, they said. So we'll see. That's pretty quick.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
And it's great having you here. And Laura, we're sending out shout outs to you, and hopefully you're doing some more amazing things over there in the UK. And for now, signing off on Real Crime Profile. Thank you for listening.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.